But it was at that time, because you're about 19 or 20, I started to really question. So what is all this happiness business? All I know is suffering of having to work really hard and the stress of examinations. And I started to look at people who had already finished university. Were they happy yet? No, because as soon as you finish university, you've got to go to work. And when you're why do you go to work? You go to work to save up money. I saw some of my friends, you know, a few years older than me, they'd finished university, they're working so hard to buy a car. And they thought, when I get enough money to buy a car, then I'll be happy. And once they got their car, then they'd have to buy a little apartment for themselves. Or they were looking for a wife, because most of my friends were men. And I looked at those men and they said, oh, when I find a wife and get married, then I'll be happy.
That's a big joke, isn't it?
You know, it's one of my favourite sayings of this guy. He'd just been married and he said, I didn't know what happiness was until I became married. And then it was too late. He said, before I got married, I used to hold the hand of my girlfriend out of love. After I got married, I used to hold her hand out of self-defense. But anyhow, the third marriage joke. If love is blind, have you heard that saying, love is blind? Yeah, then marriage is an institution for the blind. Okay, enough about marriage. Actually, marriage can be very happy and very fulfilling. Those are just jokes. But anyway, I saw some of the people who are married, and they weren't happy yet. So all this thing about when I find my partner in life, then I'll be happy. I thought, there's something wrong with that. Because when you got married, the next thing you need to do, you've got to work hard to find a house or a place to live. And it's really expensive. And sometimes you have to take on a second job and save very hard. But a lot of people think that when I bought my house, or after I bought my house, when I paid off my bank debt, then I'll be happy. And in the meantime, you have kids. And as soon as you have kids, the first couple of months or year is, you know, sort of okay. But then after a while you think, okay, when my kids grow up and leave home, then I'll be free, then I can be happy. But as soon as the kids leave home, you're still not happy yet, because you're getting close to retirement. You're getting old. And many people think that when I retire, then I can be happy. But by the time you get close to retirement, that is the time when people start going to temples and churches. And you know why they go to temples and churches when they're old? Because they think, if I go to church, I'll make enough good karma that when I die, then I'll be happy. And I noticed that most of my life and most of people's life are always thinking that when I get this, then I'll be happy. That when I, you know, win the lottery, or when I get rid of my husband, and when I, when I get enlightened, then I'll be happy. And I realize that you're missing a lot of the point there. And you realize that that actually was the meaning of suffering. Always thinking that when you get something else, then you'll be happy. It's called craving. It's called desire. And you notice what the Buddha said, that every time you have a craving, every time you want something, then you are separated from what you desire. And there is a tension there. I want, I haven't got yet. That is called suffering. It means you have to work hard. It means you have to struggle. It means you're not content. You're not happy where you are. And this is what the Buddha called suffering. That word suffering needs to be understood, because when the Buddha said that everything is suffering, I got quite depressed. So it was wonderful when I went to see some monks who were supposed to be enlightened, and I was actually surprised. These guys were happy. How can you be happy when everything is suffering? And the reason is because, yeah, there is suffering, but there's also an end of suffering as well. There's a freedom from suffering. And I was very happy to see joyful monks, because I wanted some proof. I was a scientist. And so I say, if such a thing as Nibbana exists, I want to see it. I want to see some happy and peaceful monks. And it was wonderful to actually to live with a monk like an Ajahn Chah, to see he was genuinely happy. That there was an end of suffering. And you could actually see that. And I looked at Ajahn Chah and see how he worked. And I see how he behaved. There was a man who didn't want anything. He was happy no matter what happened, but also who worked very hard teaching and helping other people. And it taught me exactly what this suffering truly is, and the end of suffering. The people who you have seen in your life who've got the very least suffering, who are they? Are they the people who are very beautiful and appear on the glossy magazine covers? Are they the happy, beautiful people? Someone told me the other day that to get on a glossy magazine cover, you have to have your photograph airbrushed 40 times. So if you see any of these supermodels in real life, they've all got pimples. They're not all like you'd expect, which is one of the problems. Now sometimes you've got to be careful here, because what we say is beauty, is a lot of that is just what we call conditioning. I was saying this morning, if you look at the pictures of, say, beautiful women or handsome men 20 years ago, they're not that beautiful after all. 40 years ago, and they're really quite ordinary. And 100 years ago, actually they're ugly. So a lot of what we call as beauty is completely conditioned. We're taught what beauty is. And one of the problems is, especially with women, it's such a hard thing trying to be beautiful. I remember going to Melbourne to give a series of talks a few years ago, and it was the winter time. And the winter in Melbourne is very, very cold. Unfortunately, the fashion at that time was to have these like high jumpers and low slung jeans. So it had this whole band of exposed flesh. And I saw a few of these girls walking down the road with their midriff all exposed. And it was going blue. It was so cold. What people had to do for fashion. Oh, it was so much suffering. Sometimes I wonder, what do we do that for? Oh, goodness. So the point of this is that sometimes we wonder, sort of, how can we really get happiness in this world, and why is there so much suffering? And other times it's the suffering, the Buddha said, is because of this desire and craving. Think that when I get this, then I'll be happy. When I change this, then things will be different. When I change my job, change my partner, change the country where I live, whatever it is you're changing, you think that then you'll be happier. And that's where I come to that story. I've already said it, I think, a couple of days ago, but I repeat it here because I'm going to expand upon it. There's a story of those two Thai girls who were sisters. And one of them, they both came for counseling. I keep on saying that one of the reasons why people come for counseling to monks is because we're cheap. Because we don't charge. And that's a very attractive. We undercut the market. But also very good as well. So, they came to me for counseling, and what was your trouble, madam, to the first lady? And her trouble was she had a husband who was having a hard time. Having a lot of difficulty, a lot of trouble, and she was actually wondering whether she should get divorced and try again. Whether, you know, they were suitable, compatible. So I said, look, when you're married to someone else, sure, it can be suffering, but it can be a lot of fulfillment as well. So you should really put more energy and effort, and told her a few tips, actually, to make a marriage work. So when I say those jokes earlier, it's not that I'm against marriage, I'm just having a bit of fun and games, because, again, some of the books and talks which I've given actually saved many marriages and kept people together and understand how they can relate better to each other. There are simple things like, you know, the old chicken and duck story, you know, don't argue over stupid things, simple things. It's much better to have your priorities right. If you're in a marriage, your love together is more important than being right. So remember why you married that person. And make that person important in your eyes. What happens very often in a marriage is we think our partner, they take us for granted, we're not important to them anymore, we feel that, and we want to talk to them, they're not listening. They always say lack of communication. So it's not that hard to get the marriage back on track. When I tell people the story of the... It's another story from the book, you've heard it many times before, I'll say it in brief. The story of the Emperor's three questions. Who is the most important... When is the most important time? Now. Who is the most important person? The one you're with, yeah. It's not yourself, it's not someone else, it's the one you're with. And the most important thing to do? To care, yeah. The Emperor's three questions. If you can always practice that with your partner, now is the most important time. The one you're with, that's your partner. They are the most important person in the world in this moment. And the most important thing to do is to care. Then you have the formula, very simple, for a very successful and intimate marriage. If the other person is doing the same to you, when you're in front of them, when you're talking, when you're together, you realize that in this moment you are the most important person in the world to your partner. That's called love. That's called togetherness. They're there and you're there. They're valuing you and you're valuing them. And then the relationship just grows from that. You don't need more information than that. To care, how does care happen? Or what actually, how is that expressed? Who knows? Care happens in many different ways. But when you have that motive, you're coming from the right place. It always works incredibly well. So remember those Emperor's three questions when you are married. Now is the most important time. Doesn't matter how long you've been married. Now is the most important time to tell your partner how much you love them and how much you appreciate them and how much you care for them. If you've done something wrong and said a stupid thing, now is the most important time to say sorry. Sorry just costs so little, but you get so much back in return. And care. And that's all a woman or a man wants from a marriage. To be given importance and to know the other person cares for them. So it's very easy to save marriages. And look at me, I'm a monk, I've never been married. And I know all about it. But in life we think, this lady, I gave her that sort of advice. And then I turned to her sister, what's your problem, madam? And her problem was that she hadn't got a husband and she wanted one desperately. All of you girls who are not married yet, who feel you're suffering because you can't find a partner in life, go and talk to a woman who has got a husband. Oh, you young men are looking for a partner. Go and look to a man who's married. Oh, you men who are married and thinking you want to be single again, go and ask a single man. What's happening here? I told that lady who was single, looking for a husband. Now, the old joke would say, why don't you swap husbands? Because you've got a husband you don't want. She wants one. Easy solution. You're sisters anyway. You're supposed to share. We can't share that much. And anyhow, I said, and this is the main part of the story, why I'm bringing it up now. I told the lady who had a husband, you have husband suffering. And it's the same. It doesn't matter, you know, what man that is. Now, they're slightly different, but they're basically the same models. So some have got a few extras, you know, like you get a car, you get a few extras, but you know, it's not that much. The engine's the same. So you've got husband suffering, and you, lady, your sister, have got single woman suffering. If you get rid of your husband, you won't have husband suffering anymore. You will have single woman suffering. And you, single woman, if you get a husband, a partner in life, you won't have single woman suffering anymore. You will have husband suffering. And so you find that just trying to change the situation you're in is not overcoming suffering. It's just exchanging one form of suffering for another. When I was at school, I thought, when I left school and go to university, then I'll be happy. All I was doing was changing school suffering for university suffering. And when you say, I'm going to finish university, it's finished now. Sure, you're letting go of university suffering. Now you have to have work suffering. When you go to work and you think you're going to retire, when you retire, you're still not happy yet. You get retirement suffering. When I was very young, you really couldn't wait to get old and have your freedom. When I was old, I realized what I'd wasted being young. And young, you were carefree, no responsibilities. When you have young, you have young person suffering. When you're middle-aged, you have middle-aged person suffering. When you're old, you have old suffering. The point is, you're not getting rid of suffering by changing the situation you're in. So, are you happy, or do you want something else? What do you aspire to? What are your dreams in life? What do you really want in life? Sometimes people want to be rich. If you're rich, you don't get rid of suffering. You have rich person suffering. And I know this because as a monk, you just go to all levels of society. Look about when I met the Queen in March. The Queen Elizabeth, I told that story a few days ago. But I felt so sorry for Queen Elizabeth. I actually found out why she wears these big hats. You know why? She always wears these long, big rimmed hats. Because one of the first ceremonies we went to was an interfaith service at St. Andrew's Cathedral in Sydney. It was a big Anglican cathedral. And so I was saying a few words there. That's part of my reason for being there. So they put me up in the choir up the front. And obviously, you know, the Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip and... the Prince Edward was there as well. They were all in the front row with John Howard and all these other dignitaries. And when I went up to give my speech, it was only a short speech. Actually, I could see her beforehand. I actually had direct view to her. And I saw her every now and again put her head down. And because of the long brimmed hat, you could not see her eyes. But every now and again, I saw her jerk her head up very quickly. She was sleeping. She was nodding off. She was having a snooze. And because she had the long rimmed hat, you couldn't see it. So that's actually why the Queen wears a long rimmed hat. So she can have a nap whenever she wants and no one knows. Except sneaky monks who are always peering. So now, you know, one day, you're sort of, you know, with Queen Elizabeth. Actually, you know, with Prince Edward. Because we're at a reception afterwards. We all went to this reception at John Howard's house. And because it's interesting, when you go to these events, there's always like, you know, the head person. So that obviously Queen Elizabeth was, you know, the number one attraction there. So everyone was crowding around her. So you got Prince Edward was actually standing alone. No one was talking to him because I'm a very compassionate monk. I decided to go and have a chat with him. And anyone of you knows Prince Edward, he can only be in his like 30s or something, but he's actually, you know, losing a lot of hair in the middle. So I went up to him and said, if you lose any more hair, you can become a Buddhist monk in my monastery. I am very irreverent. So sometimes you're hanging out with royalty, and the next moment you're working with a bricklayer. So as a monk, you actually straddle all levels of society. You go through doors where other people just can't go through. But every now and again you see these very, very rich people. You know, people have got so much money. And I remember this one occasion, I had to do a house blessing in Perth for this very, very wealthy lady. And when I went to her house, you know, for the morning meal, we sat down there. They gave us a cup of tea, first of all, while the meal was being finished. And I asked to go to the toilet. She had to draw me a map of how to negotiate all these rooms and anterooms in a mansion to get to the toilet. No exaggeration, she drew it all out, this way, that way, that way. And afterwards, I was just chatting to her and asked her, sort of, how many people live here? She said, only me. This poor woman had this huge mansion, had so much wealth, but was incredibly lonely. She had no one to share her evenings with, no one to share her joys and her pain with. She was completely alone. And I asked her why. And she said, as far as her relatives are concerned, she's afraid they may ask her for some money. And any other friends, you don't know whether they're a friend because they like her or because they just want money. It's rich person suffering. Whenever even they see a monk, they think, oh my goodness, they're going to ask for a donation for their retreat center. There was a time in the stories, in the time of the Buddha, that some of the monks were asking for so much that in this town, whenever they saw brown cows in the distance, they thought they were monks and they went to hide. They closed their doors and went, ah, the monks are coming, you can ask us for something. That's called rich person suffering. Rich people are very lonely because sometimes they can't trust their friends and relations. So, if you want to be rich and think that's going to be happiness, it's not. Sometimes I saw this article in a newspaper, this fellow who was, I think he was in the United States, he'd won the biggest lottery prize ever in history. Somewhere in the Midwest of the United States. I don't know how many hundreds of millions of US dollars. And he was just been arrested and taken to jail. Before he'd been such a happy, easygoing man. Now he got rich. He just went crazy. So rich. You know, he lost his idea of what's right and what's wrong. And he'd been put in jail for the rest of his life. And sometimes there's many, many cases like that. So sometimes, what do you want? To be happy? And why is there so much suffering in life? It's because we don't realize what's important, what's really necessary for happiness in life. Every time when I am privileged to hold a funeral service for Buddhists, and I do these funeral services sometimes twice a week, because people are always dying, and sometimes, you know, they die at the most inconvenient times. Which is why when I'm on retreat, I tell all my disciples, please don't die now. But some of them are so stubborn, they don't follow what I say. Disciples are not like they used to be in the old days. They'd always follow instructions. But whenever I do a funeral, have you ever noticed this? In the West, they have this tradition of eulogies. Where a relations or someone stands up and they say, about, you know, the life of the person who's just died. And whenever I've listened to these eulogies, never once have I heard someone say how much money this person had in the bank, or how big their house was, or what type of car they had. When a person dies, what we remember is just how kind they were, how selfless they were, how generous they were. And I've even been to Christian funerals, and it's the same. What we're saying here is at a person's death, only then, it seems, we remember what's truly important in life. The kindness, the generosity, the friendliness, the service to the community. Those things are what really count, because that is what makes for happiness.
So really what we should be aspiring towards is not to be the richest person in Kuala Lumpur, but to be the kindest. Not to have the biggest house, but to have the biggest heart. Not to be the person who is the most aggressive goal-getter, but to be the one who has the most friends, who's the most loving, who gives the most service. Not the one who gets the most, but the one who gives the most. Those are the secrets of ending suffering. But sometimes things go wrong. We think they go wrong. Sometimes people die tragically. Sometimes you lose your job. Sometimes you're meditating and eating health food and drinking ginseng tea every morning and you find you get cancer. It's unfair, we think. I did all the right things. What have I done wrong? And sometimes this is a lot of suffering for people when things apparently go wrong. Recently we had tsunamis, we had earthquakes, we have cyclones, and when these come to our communities they can create a lot of suffering. Why me, or why them? Why did this happen? Remember this key story when this man came to see my teacher Ajahn Chah, and he had been wounded in a battle because he'd been conscripted into the Thai army. He was a soldier. And he'd been shot and quite severely wounded. You know, he survived. It wasn't life-threatening, but he was partially disabled. And he came to complain to Ajahn Chah. He said, "Why me? Why did this happen? What sort of karma did I do that I took a bullet?" And Ajahn Chah looked at him and said, "Are you stupid? Are you dumb? What do you mean asking that question? You're a soldier. What do you think happens to soldiers? Now, you shoot bullets at other people. What do you expect? Other people are going to shoot bullets at you. And some of those bullets are going to hit. It's par for the course. It's to be expected. Whenever you join an army, you should read the small print. You're expected to be liable to take a bullet and be wounded. The karma which caused that to happen is joining the army." That's why it happened. And then he expanded upon that. He said, "Some people, they die young. Sometimes they die of a heart attack. Sometimes they die of a car crash. Sometimes they die of a lightning strike. Sometimes they die in a tsunami. Or sometimes they just drop down dead with heart attack, even when they're young." You say, "Why does that happen?" "Didn't you read the small print before you took birth in this human realm? Didn't you look at the contract before you came here? It was there in the small print. You can die at any time from any cause. That's being a human being. So when you understand the rules of the game, why do people die in tsunamis? It's because they're born. Because they're a human being. That's why you can get a cancer. That's why you can die. That's why a tsunami can happen. You don't know. But what you do know is a human being, the karma of being born in this human realm is that you can die at any time. Sometimes, I do a quick calculation. I look at the people. How many people on this Dharma enrichment camp today? Up and down. 200 people. Okay, a quick calculation means that by this time next year, 4 of you will be dead, according to statistics. Which 4 will it be? And don't just look at the old people. That's true. That's statistics. 4 of you will be gone by next year. Ah. Now the point is,
This is just the meaning of life. The reason why we suffer is because we have unrealistic expectations. We ask something of life which it will never give us. We ask something of our husband, our wife, our parents and our children which they can never supply. The secret of overcoming suffering is just realizing the truth of life, understanding that we can't get all these unrealistic expectations. We make our desires realistic. We get real. Husbands are like this. Wives are like that. Children are like that. They will not all become doctors and engineers and marry the person we like them to marry. They won't all live next door so we can mother them for the rest of their life. Some of them will go to England, some of them will go to the US, and some of them will go to places we'd rather them not go, but they'll go there. That's life. It's a unrealistic expectations is what causes suffering. So when we learn things like Buddhism, we make our expectations more realistic. We understand the meaning of life, what it can give us and what it can't give us, and we realize that the best thing which we can do is to care, to be kind, to be generous. That's the best we can do. We can't expect to be appreciated for our generosity. We have to give, expecting nothing back in return. We realize that happiness does not lie in some mystical place in the future. Anyone who thinks that, okay, when you die, then you'll be happy. It's just like thinking, oh, when I get married, then I'll be happy. If you get to heaven, it will disappoint you. Where you see friends, sometimes you wonder, you know, those people are like cats. Are you allowed to have a cat up in heaven? If you're allowed to have a cat, then what do the cats eat? It's not much of a heaven for the mice. Sometimes, what will happen if you've been married several times? Will your first wife, your second wife, and your third wife also be up there with you? That'll make things complicated. What about your food, those of you who aren't vegetarians? And if you like, say steaks, you know, you have to have a few cows up there being killed. That's not very nice for the cows. There was this story once about this man who went up to heaven. And up in heaven, he had to wear these white clothes. You know that you've seen like in the movies or pictures, these like long white flowing robes. And when they gave him something to eat, it was this ambrosia. That's what they're supposed to eat in heaven, just ambrosia. And the music he had to hear was this, you know, harp music. You know the harp music? And after a few weeks, he was sick of harp music because he liked rock. And this ambrosia, he was just fed up with that. He wanted something interesting, like some durian or some noodles or something. And, you know, instead of seeing all these people in white clothes, can't we have some fashion up here? It was much better back in the world, in this heaven place. And so he went up to one of the angels to complain. He said, can't we liven things up a bit up in heaven? I've worked so hard for this reward. Can't I get something better? Can't we have some decent rock bands up here? And he said, no, this is tradition. It's always been this way. And then that night he had a vision. He had a vision of hell. And down there in hell, had all these really beautiful girls, you know, really dressed up in the most modern fashion. And they had these amazing rock bands. You know, Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin. Oh, they were just rocking all night. And the food in there. Now, you think you've had delicious durian in Penang. That's nothing like he saw down in there in hell. And the noodles. Oh, I mean, they were just plates of them. And they were just so aromatic. You couldn't get noodles like that even in the best restaurant in Singapore. And so the following morning he went up to the angel. Look, I had this vision of hell. And it's a beautiful, even down there they have good rock bands. Even down there you can have nice food and beautiful women. So can't we have that up here? And the angel said, look, I told you yesterday, no. Why they got eating in hell? I don't know, but if you want to go down there, go. And he said, okay, I'll go down there. And he went down to hell, and as soon as he went down to hell, there was no rock bands. There was no nice food or beautiful women. He just got taken by these really ugly demons with these horns and, you know, long teeth, and thrown into this pot of boiling oil and poked with these sharp sticks. And he started to complain. He said, look, that's not what my vision said. In my vision, there was these beautiful women and nice rock bands and nice food and beautiful jewelry. And as these demons were poking him, he said, oh, yeah, that was our advertising campaign. That's what marketing is like, isn't it? It's not true for this whole life. And people get sucked in. That's the marketing of craving. Craving says that once I get this, then I'll be happy. Once I sort out my husband and take him to Ajahn Brahm, make Ajahn Brahm make him this nice, soft, beautiful guy. He always does what he's told. Or bring my children to the Dhamma school here in BGF, because the Dhamma school will turn my child into something who always says nice things to his parents and does what they're told and does well at school. All of our craving is like a marketing. And sometimes we miss the point that our real happiness is right here, right now, with people we are with. I'll finish off this part with one of the secrets to the ending of craving. It's one of the secrets of happiness. And this was, again, a story from the book. It's a beautiful story. That's why I don't mind repeating this many, many times, because it's very deep. It's the story of that monk who went to prison to teach prisoners. And after going many weeks, the prisoners invited him to stay behind for tea. And they started asking him about what it's like in a forest monastery. How you have to get up early at 4 o'clock. How you have to work very hard. How there's no sex, no sport, there's no television, there's no radio, there's no music. We have to meditate all day, sleep on the floor, eat one meal a day, all in the same bowl, not getting what we want. And actually, the prisoners were so surprised, because in prison it's much easier than in a forest monastery. Physically, it's more comfortable going to jail than being a monk. That's why if you ever do anything wrong and go to jail, for me, a jail will be like a holiday camp, like a resort. Compared to some of the monasteries I've been in. And, can you not hear? Okay, I'll try a bit. Is that better? Okay. So, we were comparing the prison with the monastery. And the monastery was more ascetic, more austere, and physically harder to endure than a prison. And so one of the prisoners, out of misplaced compassion for their monk friend who they got to love, not thinking what they were saying, was saying, that's so terrible, so hard in your monastery. Why didn't you come in here and stay with us instead? They invited him into jail. And only then, when he realized what he was saying, did he burst out laughing. But the point of that story was, why? My monastery has got 21 monks. It's only supposed to have 20 huts, but we've got an extra one there. And another one is going to be ordaining before the range retreat started. I don't know where I'm going to put them. And there's a whole list, a waiting list of people wanting to join. Why is there a waiting list of people trying to join a monastery? And it's so ascetic and hard. But there's a waiting list of people trying to leave prison. They can't get out soon enough. Why do people want to get out of jail? Why do so many people want to become monks, even though it's such a hard, physical, demanding life? The point is, the people who are in a monastery want to be there. It's like choice, but I'm putting it, they want to be there. In a prison, you don't want to be there. That is the main difference. And from that, I realized that
life has many prisons for you. Any place you don't want to be is your prison. It's suffering. If you are in a marriage and you don't want to be there, if you're in a job and you don't want to be there, if you're the vice president of the BGF and you don't want to be there, then your job is a prison for you. If you're a monk and you'd rather be somewhere else, then being a monk is a prison for you. If you're sick with a cancer, if you're dying, and you don't want to be sick, then your body becomes a prison for you. And this is how you feel. Any place you don't want to be is your prison. The Buddha understood that. And he talked about how to escape from prison. How do you escape from the prisons of life? You don't need to change your job, to change your partner, to change your body to being healthy again. That is not how you escape from prison. As I said earlier, if you change your partner for another one, you're just going from one prison to another prison. The only way you escape from prisons is changing your attitude from not wanting to be here to wanting to be here. When you want to be here, you're ending craving. You're happy to be here. You learn contentment. This is good enough. Take it from me, who's seen many husbands and wives in counseling. Your husband is good enough. It might surprise you, but that's as good as it gets. If you try and change your model, you probably get a worse one. Your wife, you think that the girl in the office is better, is prettier, or is better in bed. You'll find, no, your wife is good enough. In fact, she's probably better, but sometimes you don't appreciate it. If you want to be here, and this is good enough, there you'll find contentment, the secret of the end of suffering. Your job, if you think, oh, if I could only get that promotion, then I'll be happy. Think about it. If you get that promotion with more responsibility, you'll have to work even harder. You'll get more stress. So when the other girl in the office gets the preferment, whew, that was a close one. Lucky me. I don't have to get that extra stress. And if you think, wow, I'm not getting as much money as her. Remember what I said yesterday. Your salary, the amount they pay you, it's only a bribe. Your salary is a bribe paid for the company, by the company, for doing something you'd rather not do. The more they pay you, the more detestable is the work you have to do, the harder it is. Otherwise they wouldn't need to pay you, would they? If you enjoyed your work and was having a good time, never tell your boss, otherwise I'd cut your salary. So more pay means more pain. So you look at it that way. And then out of compassion to your Christian colleague in the office, you get the promotion, you get the promotion. I'm so kind. You take the suffering. Because it doesn't matter how much they pay you, is it ever enough? If they double your salary, is it enough? The more they pay you, the more you want. That's a problem. So this is good enough. Okay, I'm not getting the best salary, but it's good enough. I haven't got the best job in the company, but oh, this is good enough. I haven't got the most beautiful body in the world, but this one is good enough. I haven't got the most best kids in the world, but this is good enough. When you have this beautiful good enough, then you're content. Doesn't mean you're lazy and you don't work hard in the world. You work hard, But working hard, that's good enough. You don't work hard to get something. You work to give something. That's the difference. Too many people, they're working hard to get something back. But real effort, real love, is working not to get, but to give. How can I help the company? How can I help my family? How can I help my society? This is the meaning of life. So it's a craving which becomes impersonal, and it does not lead to suffering. When you want to get something, that when I do this, then I become happy, that is suffering. When you do something, you work really hard, not to get anything back, but just to give, that's happiness. So whenever I go anywhere, whenever I do anything, it's not to get anything, it's just to give. That's why people say, Ajahn Brahm, why do you work so hard? You should disrobe and become a CEO of some big company, and then you wouldn't have to work so hard. Because I do work hard. Sometimes people don't understand how hard monks work. I do 16-hour days usually, 7 days a week. I don't get any holidays. This is supposed to be a long weekend. For who? In our monastery we call it rest days. And the rest days means the rest can have a holiday while I have to work. That's why I call it a rest day. The rest is okay, but I still have to keep going. So sometimes I work really, really, really hard as a monk. But I get a lot of happiness. Why is that? Because when I work hard, I don't work to get anything. I work hard to give. And I found a secret of happiness. If when you work to get something, you're going to suffer. You probably won't get it. And if you do get it, it's not what you thought it was. That's why Oscar Wilde once said, there's two tragedies in life. There's two causes of suffering in life. He said the first cause of suffering is not getting what you want. And the second cause of suffering is getting what you want. You find it's not what you expected, and it disappoints you. All desires are unfaithful to you. They promise you happiness, but once you get it, you find it's unfaithful. It doesn't give you happiness after all. It breaks its promise. Once you get that new car, you think, now I'm going to be happy. No, the promise is broken. You're not happy. It's strange how those marketing things work. One of the stories was a time when I was a young student, and I saw this advertisement on the TV for St. Bruno Tobacco. It was a great advertisement, because there was this ordinary looking guy, and I was an ordinary looking guy, and he was walking down the street alone, didn't have a girlfriend, no one really cared about him, but then he put some of this tobacco in his pipe. These were the days before we knew that smoking causes cancer. And he put this St. Bruno tobacco in his pipe and lit it, and the aroma started spreading down the street. And there was this incredibly gorgeous chick in the bank. And she smelled this St. Bruno tobacco, and she was smitten. She jumped over the counter and was following this guy, captivated. And then this lady in the newsagent, she was this beautiful redhead. And she just jumped over the counter too and was following this guy for the St. Bruno tobacco. And this other person in the grocery store, another beautiful young girl, also was smitting. And in about 1 minute they had this line of incredibly gorgeous women following this ordinary looking guy because St. Bruno tobacco captivates women. Stupid, wasn't it? Who would believe that? I did. I bought some St. Bruno tobacco. It didn't work for me. Nobody followed me down the street. Just as well, otherwise I wouldn't have made it to be a monk. But why is it that we have these fantasies and dreams about what life can give us and we get sucked into it? So we always think that things could be better. So really, this is good enough. So be happy with what you have. And in the meantime, see how you can give and contribute to your family, to your friends, to society. That is the secret of happiness. When I look back upon my life, my happiest moments were the times when I gave the most, or the times when I saw other great acts of kindness and generosity. What are the happiest times of your life? Were they the times you got what you want? When your soccer team won the championship? Really, was that the best time? When I really look back, the most beautiful, happiest times of my life was when I gave the most, when I served the most. I remember this last little story. I think 3 years ago, almost 3 years to the day, we held a Waisak ceremony in Perth. It was the 30th anniversary of our Buddhist society in Western Australia. And it's just my character that I said, let's do it big. Let's do it in the open air. Let's have a big ceremony in what is like the central field in Perth, the Supreme Court Gardens. So other people said, no, we haven't got the resources. So let's just do it. You know, Nike, do it. Have faith. It will work. So we put a lot of resources, a lot of people, we really just worked so hard making it happen. A big ceremony, having to get permission from the local council because this was open air, this wasn't in a little temple. Really big, inviting as many people as we possibly could, including the Premier of Western Australia, the Governor of Western Australia, all these big shots. When I woke up that morning, it was pouring down with rain. I looked at the weather forecast. It was going to get worse. A big storm was approaching the coast. One of the worst storms on record. Three times the Premier's department called me. Are you cancelling? Each time I said, no, of course not. They thought we were crazy. One of my disciples was an ex-sailor. He took me aside and said, look, I've been watching the barometer. It's falling, falling, falling. There's a low pressure front coming. I've been a sailor all my life. This is a storm. Cancel, don't be stupid. I said, no. One of my monks was shouting at me, you're stupid, Ajahn Brahm. You've got to cancel, look. Science, reasoning, you're supposed to be a scientist. It's pouring down with rain. We can't do this. Said no. So we went there in the pouring rain, set it up. We took a big Buddha statue through the rain and set it up in the park. People were getting soaked, putting all the things together. We had a few tents. I was in there arranging the chairs. It was about 6:30. We had about half an hour before we began. I always remember this Burmese girl running into the tent crying, Ajahn Brahm, come quick, come quick. I went out. It had stopped raining. More than that, the clouds had parted. It was full moon night, and everyone was looking up at this full moon in the middle of the parted clouds. For the next couple of hours, we did our ceremony. We had TV camera there. The TV crew, or rather the journalist, the presenter, kept on saying, this is eerie. This is eerie. This is eerie. We did not get much of a turnout. I found out only later that people to the east of the central part of Perth and to the west, to the north and to the south, hadn't come. They looked out of their window and there was a heavy storm. Rain was lashing down, branches were coming off trees. They looked out their window and thought, he must have cancelled. You can't have a ceremony like this. All around the central area, the storm raged. In the central area, not only was it calm, but you could see the full moon as well. As the ceremony finished, the moon disappeared, the rain came down again. You have experiences like that, I'm sure, here. But that was just immense. After that night, that field flooded. The freeway in Perth was closed. It's the only time I know that to have happened since I've lived in Perth for 23 years. Biggest storm. But it stopped for Waysack. I worked so hard for that ceremony. The following morning, so I had to go to Melbourne to do another ceremony. I hardly slept the night. I was so tired and exhausted. I got to the airport, checked in, went to a corner, and realized what we've done. And I cried. I cried tears of joy. Because only then did I realize just how much so many people have given. And when you give so much, other beings help out as well. Now that was one of the most beautiful experiences. To see when you don't do things to get something, but you do it to give, and amazing things happen. Things like that are what brings happiness. When you want something out of it, you just get suffering. Now do you understand how you can work your butt off, as they say in the West? If it's for you, you get suffering. If it's for others, for the goodness of society, the community, whatever, then no suffering at all. Just beautiful joy. So it's not getting something, it's giving. As Ajahn Chah said, you don't meditate to get something, you meditate to let go of things. That's what Buddhism is all about. So, there we go. Suffering and the end of suffering.